Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by Halt Daddy Hazy IPA, award-winning beer by Greater Good Brewing, built by Penn Staters for PA. Look for the green can at your local retailer.
Hello and welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show. I'm Jim Galante. He is Steve Pavlik. How are we doing this week, Steve?
Pretty good, Jim. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Not too bad. You know, it's a bit of a quiet time in college football, the off season. So I thought for today's show we'd do something a little different. I wanted to take a look, do a big picture kind of thing. Like, let's look at where we are in the college football world. We can then segue that to where Penn State fits in this new era. And there's no other way to put it. I mean, everything is new with football. And because I just think of you as a big picture kind of guy, Steve. So you're the right guy to talk to when we go big picture.
Well, I do work for a macro research firm, so I guess there's some merit to that.
All right. That's the way to go. Macro. We're going macro today. So let's start with this. So many of the things that have changed the game. I want to start with NIL, okay? And we'll start real basic with the question. This came into reality a couple years ago. And just your thought off the top, NIL, I know it hasn't turned out the way it was planned to, but forget that for a moment. Just the idea that the student athletes are being compensated. Are you good with that, or are you the guy that's longing for the old days when they should be happy with the scholarship?
I guess I'm a little torn. I mean, part of me sees the change in the value proposition. I mean, you look at college football and where it originated and what differentiated it from the professional model, the NFL, it was you're coming here to go to school and also play football, and sort of the value at the time, the proposition was, we're going to cover your education costs. And that was enough to entice people to do this. And, you know, I think what this does now is really put players, I mean, they're professionals. They're going to be employees of the university. And, you know, that just sort of changes the dynamic a lot. I'm sure we'll talk about the transfer portal too. I think the two of them really changed the incentive structure there. And I guess, you know, part of me is sympathetic to, you know, with all the money that was going to college football. I mean, it did seem to me that the players, the ones actually putting the product on the field, should share in some of that. I mean, the outrageous salaries for the coaches and stadium renovations and some of the things that we saw with the locker room, if there's going to be an arms race, I mean, part of me empathizes with, okay, the players are the ones actually on the field. They should actually receive some of this. But at the same time, it just really, in my view, just makes them less of a student and more of an employee, presumably at some point of the school. And I guess that's my fear of big picture.
And I know the term employee has some connotations that come with it. And whether they're officially an employee or not, that's kind of what the status has turned into, right?
Right. I mean, if somebody's paying you to provide a service, I mean, you're an employee, a professional. I mean, again, maybe the check's not directly coming from the university yet. It seems like that might be where we're headed. But yeah, that's just someone who works in the real world, in the private sector. People pay you to produce a product, and that's essentially what's going on here now. And again, that just changes the incentive structure. So then you start going, what do the people want in return for that? I fear it's just going to be for those young men going through the process, you know, are they going to get any value now out of the education that they were supposed to before? We've talked before about how so few of them actually go on to the NFL, and even the ones that do aren't there for very long. And so you just look at the course of your life, you know, are you going to regret not really taking advantage of that opportunity to get that education and do something other than football?
Well, you bring up some really good points. I want to circle back, though, to this, you know, the compensation happened with the NIL ruling. But college football has turned into a big business, okay? It's a billion-dollar business. And when I think that the way the sport used to be, it was more similar to high school sports than it was to professional sports. You know, it was a nice activity. The players enjoyed participating at the collegiate level, getting a scholarship. You were getting something that the rest of the student body wasn't, as quote unquote compensation for your efforts, which was all really good. But I think when it became such a big business, the mistake that the NCAA and college football in general made was they just put off the inevitable. If they would have stepped forward and said, you know what, hey, the players deserve a cut of this, they're bringing in so much of the money, let's pay them a certain amount, it would have been a reasonable amount that I think the players would have been very happy with, and everything would have gone forward. College football did it to themselves. They allowed it to go to a court ruling. Now, it started with NIL, and let's understand, NIL is name, image, and likeness. It was created, Steve, not for schools to pay a player. It was supposed to be, okay, Nick Singleton chose Penn State as to where he wanted to go to school, where he wanted to play football. And, oh, by the way, over here on the side, because he's become this famous football player, his autograph is worth something. His endorsement, his name behind a car dealership or whatever, now has value. And instead of the university getting that money, he would. The problem, as far as I'm concerned, is that got translated very quickly into, you know what, we'll pay you X dollars to come to our university.
I agree. I mean, the highway to hell is paved with good intentions, and why NIL may have been initially well-intentioned and well-conceived, you know, the fact is it created this giant loophole, and now it's just become an arms race, is which school can pay the most players. I think that's sort of the absence of guardrails. I know we'll probably talk about the House case in a bit, but you know, I think the fear moving forward, if that's going to be the situation where basically it's just a financial arms race, my concern is it's more just a concentration in terms of the teams that have the most financial, or schools that have the most financial resources, are just going to have the best teams. And there are going to be fewer teams that are going to be able to compete with that. And does that just diminish the support for college football and erode it over time? Because if you're going to have the same teams, and I understand people will say, well, right now we already have a lot of the same teams and same programs, you know, year in and year out. And I get that. But I just think they're going to be even fewer of them moving forward if this is the direction that we're headed in. And at that point, I just think interest in the sport is going to decline. And they may be penny wise and pound foolish now. But I think you're also right to point out that there's nobody, this is a macro themed show, there's nobody looking out for the big picture of the sport. You have the SEC and the Big Ten, respectively, just looking out for their best interest. And I don't blame them for that, because that's sort of the role of the commissioner. But absent somebody with a macro view to just look at, okay, directionally, what should college football be doing? The NCAA has been abysmal. Not exactly a profile in courage or leadership there. But there's been nobody to take their place. And so I think in the absence of that, unfortunately, I think we're on this treadmill now with the SEC and the Big Ten in particular, doing what's in their best interest, maybe at the expense of the game long term.
Again, you hit a lot of great points. Let me hit on a couple of them. First, the idea in my heart, my instincts say this is going to be bad as far as trying to provide any kind of parity in college football. But then I look at it a little closer and say, not just over the last decade, but you could go over the last half century and there's a dominant team. You know, you could go back to the 50s, and I think Oklahoma didn't lose a game in 5 years. Okay. Then in the late 60s or so, you had like Texas as a dominant team. Then there were the dominant Miami teams, the dominant Florida State teams. And it's just recently we've had the Georgia and Alabama and Ohio State dominant teams. What I find interesting, though, now that we're into this NIL a bit, I feel like previously there was no real avenue for a lesser team to become one of the better teams. And now, though, even if you don't like it, there's at least a path to get there. And that path is money. So if an Oregon with Phil Knight and is Oklahoma State with Pickens and a school now has an opportunity, and I think of the current team that shows that is SMU, who they use their money to get themselves into the ACC. And I think they use their money to bring in enough players that they were a playoff team this year.
Well, part of me can't help but wonder, too. You know, we saw that area you were alluding to where the SEC sort of have a moment there in the sun. Now, presumably, they may have been already paying their players. And so somebody might point out the fact that the Big Ten won the national championship last couple of years. Now the Big Ten's actually able to pay their players, too. So maybe there's some correlation there. I'm not entirely sure. But, again, I just worry longer term. If it's going to come down to, you know, which schools have the financial resources to do this, does that make for an interesting product? Is that something that is going to maintain the appeal that college football has had for so long? I guess that's my concern.
I guess I'll take it from a little different angle. My concern is what happened to the Pac-12. They got, and we're going to get to, you know, this where the conferences have changed and are raiding other conferences. But do we reach the point where I don't feel like it's the money directly has done it, but this Southeast Conference Big Ten cabal where they're, you know, getting together saying we're the big kids, we're the bullies, and we're going to strip those other conferences until there's nothing left. And essentially you have a Big Ten Southeast Conference college football world, Steve.
Yeah, I guess what I would retort to that would be, I think the reason the Big Ten and the SEC have as much power as they do is because they have significantly more money than the other conferences. And I think that's sort of the direction everything's getting pulled into, unfortunately.
And that is exactly the point. And it's about those TV contracts. So it's funny, whenever I hear somebody say, gee, the Southeast Conference and the Big Ten are the two powers in college football. Well, actually, it's Fox and ESPN who are their television networks. They're the ones who are pushing the buttons, pulling the strings, and making all this activity happen. All right, that's going to be it, Steve, for quarter number one. We got a lot more to go on this topic. Stay tuned. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by Halt Daddy Hazy IPA, award-winning beer by Greater Good Brewing, built by Penn Staters for PA. Look for the green can at your local retailer.
Hello and welcome back to quarter number two of the Keystone Kickoff Show. He's Steve, I'm Jim. We're going big picture on the college football world. I started with the seemingly simple question of NIL, should players get paid or not? And I think we're in agreement, Steve, that it's not so much players getting compensated, but where it went from there. It wasn't what it was intended to be with NIL. And, you know, and you brought this up too, as far as like the product on the field, it may not change because players are getting paid, but the combination of players getting paid and essentially free agency, which we call the transfer portal, you combine the two, and it's become a different game.
It has. And I think go back to what's the incentive structure. I mean, if you're coming here now to just get paid, you're just going to go to the highest bidder, which we talked about working in the private sector. I mean, that's sort of understood now. But it just really, I think, moves you further away from the idea of being a student who's there to actually get an education? I think that's sort of the fear. Now, look, at the same time, just like I had some sympathy for, you know, players should share in this large revenue. I think the revenue should be directed to them more than where it was headed. I'm also sympathetic to allowing players to transfer. I mean, sometimes, you know, you get recruited and there's a coaching change. And now, you know, you used to be an option quarterback and some team wants to run the run and shoot. Okay, well, look, clearly it would make sense for you to go somewhere else. I think you should be free to do that. I'm also sympathetic to the idea where, hey, you know, I was recruited and they recruited somebody who's younger than me, who's going to play ahead of me, and now I'm not going to get a chance to play. So, you know, you should be able to take your talents elsewhere. So I think that's sort of the tension here is you should allow people to move, but now if it's just becoming, hey, I'm going to play here for 1 year and then I'm going to go somewhere else because they're going to pay me more and then maybe you can transfer again. That's where this whole thing just sort of, you know, I think falls apart. And even in the NFL, you know, you have contracts and things that try to prevent most players from just simply hopping around year to year like that.
Well, it's interesting. The whole thing is the sky falling. Okay. And my first instinct, transfer portal, sympathetic to the players. If you're a normal college student, you can transfer universities. And you brought up the point, which I think is a very good one. Hey, I came in as a pocket quarterback and they're changing to an option running, you know, offense. It doesn't fit me. Or probably even the more relevant issue is, there's a star in front of me, especially at the quarterback position. Bo Prabhul has been a very good soldier at Penn State for a couple of years playing as the backup. And now this year, I have no blame on Bo Prabhul for moving on and getting an opportunity to start, plus make a nice paycheck. I don't deny him that at all. Now, the interesting part to this is it truly is total free agency every year for the players. And I had somebody pointed this out, and I thought it was great. Probably the best player in college football is the wide receiver from Ohio State, Jeremiah Smith, right? Someone's pointed this out. Why doesn't he just declare free agency? Now, he loves playing in Columbus. He loves playing at Ohio State. I get it, but why not put yourself out in the market, find your market value? Is he worth $10 million to a Southeast Conference team? You know what? Take that offer back to Columbus and say, look, again, using the private sector analogy, Steve, if you could, you know, somebody, another company offered you twice the money to go work there, you could certainly take that back to your current company and say, look, you know, I have to take care of my family.
Yeah, no, I'm sympathetic to that. I think Smith is an interesting example because if he's somebody where his offensive coordinator's left, I think the quarterback is gone. So you could see a case for him just absent the money to go somewhere else. But then you throw in the money on top of that, and now you start to wonder, is he going to come back to Ohio State? But go one step further. Would he go to Michigan? They just got one of the top quarterbacks there, I think, in the country coming in. And that's where I think this whole thing is headed, and that's just how far we've come from where it was. I mean, the idea of an Ohio State receiver going to Michigan in the era of Woody Hayes and Bo Schembechler, you wouldn't even fathom that. And it goes back to, you know, what were you signing up for? Were you signing up for to be a student, part of a school, part of a tradition, versus now, hey, I'm just an employee trying to get paid, and I'll go wherever the highest bidder is. And the latter, to me, is just that greater separation between the relationship between the player and the students. You know, before, when you went to school, there was sort of this idea, well, I may be in class with some of these guys. You know, it's interesting, you know, that I know this person, we're going through the same experience here in the classroom. And then on Saturday, they have a very different experience. And I go out there and I watch them, and I sort of relate to that. I sort of feel a connection there. I just feel the more that the players become more employees rather than students, you're going to lose that connection. And then you think, again, long-term, what are you watching? If you're just looking for the best professional product, you're not going to compete with the NFL. What does that mean for college football longer term? Yeah, I don't think anybody's really thinking about that, at least not people in the position of power, which is the SEC commissioner and the Big Ten commissioner and the two corresponding networks.
Well, and we'll get to that. And it leads to, are you rooting for the laundry and no longer the players? But everyone who listens to our show on a regular basis, Steve, knows I'm a big baseball fan, okay? So I'd like to relate to, instead of NFL free agency, it's probably closer to Major League Baseball free agency, where there's not a salary cap and there's the haves and the have-nots. But what's interesting is 50-some years ago, when free agency hit Major League Baseball, there was all this, the sky's falling, okay? It's going to be the end of the game because there was free agency. Well, as it turned out, that didn't happen. But I thought what's really fascinating is one of the owners at the time suggested, instead of free agency being, well, after so many years, you become a free agent and you sign a 5-10 year contract, which is crazy. He said, let's just make them all free agents every year, because you'd now have a big enough supply that the demand wouldn't be so great. If there's only a handful of guys who are free agents, gee, you know, the bidding gets crazy. And it also translated into contracts that it's not so much an issue of how much you're paying, but for how many years. So if you made them all free agents, his theory was it wouldn't be this craziness because there's so much, so many opportunities, so many open jobs. Players would end up sticking around with where they are. Hey, I live here. You know what? If the salary's close and I'm playing in Pittsburgh, I'll stay in Pittsburgh here with my family, my friends, and I would stick around. Just like in private industry where, you know, Steve, you're in D.C. Now, that's a very specific town in for what you do. But if your job was something you could do anywhere in the country, you probably wouldn't be racing off because the offers would be comparable and you're home in D.C. Long way for me to say this, and we were talking about Jeremiah Smith, who seemed like an obvious example. Declare your free agency, get a bidding war. But he didn't. Look at the Penn State roster. The vast majority of guys are not declaring free agency and going to the highest bidder. That, I guess my question is, are we over concerned about the sky falling? And really, it just isn't.
Well, we're still very much in the infancy of this. We've got to see where it's going. The other thing I think that's important to note is for many of these players, you know, college football is not the ultimate destination. It's not the ultimate paycheck. It's the NFL. And I think the case for staying where you are, particularly if you're playing, is you're still going to have an opportunity to showcase your talents on the field. You're familiar with the coaches. And if that's your real goal, maybe you're sort of better off thinking I could stay here, because the real paycheck could be, you know, that NFL situation down the road. And maybe that's sort of causing more people just to sort of stay put. I mean, that would be part of my decision calculus if I were in that spot.
What's interesting, this is maybe me flipping positions with you in the debate here or the discussion. Well, let me start with this. You think Bo Perbola is an NFL quarterback?
No.
Okay. I don't either. For his sake, I hope he gets a chance. Who knows? Maybe hang around for a couple years. But what does that mean then? This now, right now in college, as a college football player and maybe even a college football star, this is probably his biggest opportunity to make money.
For Prabula, it is. I guess I'm arguing it from the perspective of Smith. It may make more sense to just stay where you are.
Right. So, you know, you have two different types of players. Smith, he'd be the number one draft pick probably if he were out and available this year. In two more years, when he will become available, he will probably be the number one pick and make a gazillion dollars. I'm sure he's getting paid nicely in college at Ohio State. But if you're Bo Prabula now, where he grew up a Penn State fan, and maybe he still loves Penn State, or if all else equal or for, you know, if pay wasn't part of the issue, staying at Penn State might make sense. I talked earlier about in the private sector, you're in D.C., that's your home. Pennsylvania is my home. I wouldn't necessarily look to move for a comparable salary. But for $1.5 million, maybe I'd move to Missouri, Steve.
Well, I think for Prabula, too, you talk about the quarterback position being relatively unique, and I think that's true in the sense that only one person, you know, is on the field that plays that spot, and you know, you only have so many years to showcase your talents. And so that's why I sort of understand Prabula saying, look, I want to get out of here. I want to play. I only have so many years to do this. I can't afford to sit around for another one, as much as I love Penn State.
Yes, and that's exactly the point. And I'm not sure that's a bad thing, okay, that here, you know, a career backup quarterback at Penn State essentially gets an opportunity to make a nice paycheck and get on the field. Now, when we come back, Steve, I want to follow up on the transfer portal. And just like NIL and compensation, it starts somewhere, okay? And it ends up in a completely different place than what was intended in the beginning. We might say, hey, player transfer, that's a good thing. When we come back, I'm going to give you another question about something that's currently a court case. I want to get your take on it when we come back. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, Enjoy Cafe Tea pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by Hulk Daddy Hazy IPA, award-winning beer by Greater Good Brewing, built by Penn Staters for PA. Look for the green can at your local retailer.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's quarter number three. He's Steve Pavlik. I'm Jim Galante. We're talking big picture in college football and all these things that are changing the game, NIL, the transfer portal. And we finished up quarter number two. We were talking transfer portal. And Steve, I kind of teased the idea that just like NIL, we have with the transfer portal, it's becoming something that was never intended. And where I'm headed with this is we have an Ask Andy segment of our show, and we'll get questions about the latest one last week was, gee, Saquon Barkley still has a year of eligibility. If he finishes up his NFL career, couldn't he come back and play for Penn State? And my take on that was, well, Saquon Barkley is going to get beat up as a running back. He's making $20 million a year. No, he's not going to come back and play at Penn State. But what if things don't work out for Kobe King in the NFL?
I mean, I guess it's possible. I don't know that it's probable. But, I mean, is that really where we're headed? I mean, well, if so, that just shows the point that you're trying to make, that this whole thing's falling apart.
Right. Well, let me tell you about a current court case. Not exactly the same, but it gives you the same idea of where we're headed. We used to get, I know, multiple questions we've gotten is the football season starts, and I can't remember what player it was. Someone transferred from Penn State to Pitt, okay? And someone said, what's to keep that from happening in the middle of the season? Or what if, you know, a Penn State player transferred to, I'll use Michigan, because they're known to skirt the rules when possible, but midseason, 2 weeks before Penn State's ready to play Michigan, kid transfers to Michigan. Two things: hand over the playbook, number one, and number two, could he play for Michigan? Now, that might seem crazy, and the NCAA actually has a rule, Steve, that says you can't play for two different schools in the same school year. Okay? Guess what? That issue is in court right now with a golfer. And apparently, at least at some schools, They have golf in the fall and in the spring. She played in one match, one tournament, whatever, in the school in the fall. And now she has transferred to another school. It's now a new semester. She wants to play at the second school in the spring. Now, this is golf, especially with it from fall season to spring. I see no issue, no problem with that at all. I really don't. My fear, though, is if the court says, hey, NCAA, you can't restrict someone from transferring and playing, is that the kind of thing that opens up the Pandora's box? And using other examples, it, you know, the player who declares for the NFL maybe either doesn't make a team or plays for 1 year and gets cut. What's to keep them from taking it to court and going back? Because the NCAA, the rule is supposed to be you have 5 years to use 4 years of eligibility. If that goes to court, you think it would hold up?
Well, you should have asked my dad. He's the lawyer, not me. but I guess where I'm worried, we all know how abysmal the NCAA record is in these court cases. What I don't know, just going back to like, what is the intent here? You would think you wouldn't want to transfer as a student in the middle of the year, because would you even be able to enroll in courses? What would transfer ever? What wouldn't? So again, if your original goal was to try to get a degree, that would sort of take that off the table, the idea of trying to do it mid-season. I guess the golf example that she gives may be more interesting, because you actually play golf in one semester, then you could transfer at a natural time for a second semester and roll in your courses and have all that squared away. But yeah, I mean, that's sort of where I think the concern is. And as the NCAA becomes increasingly less relevant moving forward, I'm just not going to, I don't have that much confidence. Are they going to be able to enforce any sort of structure here?
Well, let's shift gears a little bit, Steve. And we now do have NIL, the portal, like you referenced earlier, the House case, which it looks like it's coming to a settlement. The biggest change that we'll see from that case is the schools will be able to compensate players directly. And they have a formula that calculates it. It's like $21 million. So there'll be the calculation. How much goes to football, basketball, goes to the rest. But the analogy to the NFL, as you pointed out, does it now become about money management and the general manager position? We're seeing that happen at more and more schools, because you probably need someone, you know, how do we distribute our money? Someone could argue, well, the quarterback position is so important. Let's allocate, you know, the vast majority of our money to the best quarterback in the country. Or we mentioned Jeremiah Smith. Should I, you know, from an opposing school, offer him this boatload of money and then not have enough money for the rest of the team?
Well, and just the quarterback, you know, say, hey, look, if I have an opportunity to throw to Smith, maybe I'll take less money to try to spend it on him. I don't know how that's going to work, but I think you raise an interesting point about the importance, even more so moving forward, of a general manager. I mean, you know, and then I sort of look at that as, who's a general manager reporting to? Is it going to be the head coach, or is it more likely going to be the athletic director? Is the athletic director going to sort of, you know, keep the GM around in the event that the coach leaves? Are there going to be friction there as to, you know, who's playing, as we see sometimes in other sports, as to who's really making the decisions there? I mean, that's something to keep an eye on. With respect to the House case, too, I mean, one thing that concerns me is, you know, you can have these laws, but they're only as good as the people who enforce them. So you may have this idea where schools are only supposed to spend $20 million or so on their football budget, but what's to prevent outside money from coming in there and maybe influencing this beyond the $20 million? Sort of going back to what we had before, where the SEC sort of paying players, you know, under the table to try to lure them there. You know, that's sort of my fear is just, you know, can you really enforce that? Are we just going to go back to, you know, hey, this is what $20 million, everybody else sort of playing by the rules, but teams that are skirting these and not really being held account, do they have a competitive advantage moving forward?
Well, one point to clarify is the money coming from the schools does not eliminate NIL.
Right. And that's sort of my point. So now it's just going to be, you're going to have NIL in addition to the $20 million.
Do you think, though, that it will change things a bit in that you're not dependent on outside money, so that I do think there's a point where there's going to be donor fatigue, okay? And also, hey, $20 million is already going into the – and by the way, that's for sports across the board, not just football, although that's where most of the money will end up. But will you have a situation where NIL will be more about special cases? You know, you mentioned Michigan bringing in the number one ranked quarterback out of high school this past year, Bryce Underwood, I believe his name is. Okay, that's a special case. Let's go get some outside money that we need, you know, to compete for that.
I just see it as an inflationary impact. I mean, now it's like, okay, $20 million sort of with your operating budget, and you're still going to rely on the schools that have the NIL in addition to that. To me, it's just raising the price to play, which, again, I just think is going to make it more difficult for schools to continually to do that. Now, at some point, you're right. You would assume that some of these donors are going to get fatigued and start questioning if they're not getting a return on their investment here. So how sustainable is that? But these bigger programs, presumably they have enough donors to try to sustain it. So it's just not a very encouraging direction. As you said, it was sort of college football moves closer and closer to the NFL model and further away from the high school model.
One of the things also with the House settlement is, and don't laugh, but they actually apparently are putting in also that the NIL money has to be legitimate. Like there's a threshold so that anything above $600 payment, they have to justify that it's legit, that you're being paid by the, you know, car dealership. That, you know, I just saw, by the way, a pretty funny commercial. I don't know if you've seen it, with Arch Manning, his father, and his grandfather, Archie Manning, and they were in the driverless Uber or whatever. The commercial is hilarious. It's really good. But Arch Manning obviously is getting compensated for that, and it's his name value, which that's how NIL was supposed to be. Just looking at you, shaking your head, you don't think it's going to work?
No. I mean, how are you going to enforce this? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I just go back to, are you relying on the NCAA to do this? I mean, what's their track record been with enforcement?
Well, it's supposed to be an independent group that's going to be put together to do this, not the NCAA. And to me, I think it's got to be, you know, the schools themselves. Are they reaching the point where they're exhausted with this also, and that they are going to play ball with it? But again, all it takes is one group to say, no, we're taking this to court, and lose, and then Pandora's box is opened up. Before we get to where Penn State sits in all of this, I think also we're looking at, you know, the transfer portal, NIL. But Steve, I wonder how much of this was created by the conferences themselves. When the Southeast Conference grabs a Texas and Oklahoma, offering them more money, the Big Ten grabs all the West Coast teams, which, you know, it's the Big Ten's fault that the Pac-12 went away. Are we now going to see something like that happen to the ACC? They'll start cherry picking Florida State, Clemson, Miami, and what's left will fall apart.
Well, I think that's the direction this is headed in. I mean, it goes back to the money. Those were the SEC and the Big Ten were the schools that had the money. They were able to demand the big TV deals and the contracts there. And the schools that want to remain competitive need to gravitate towards this conference because they know in order to maintain their ability to be competitive, they have to have money. And I think when you combine the conference realignment, NIL, the transfer portal, I mean, it's unfortunately just all about the money. And I think you associate money with professionalism, and it's just moving away from the game that many of us grew up rooting for.
And you know what, Steve, no matter what the question is, ultimately the answer is money. Yeah. If you look for it, that's what the source of it is, source of the issue. And in conference realignment, Now, when we come back for quarter four, I want to talk a little bit more about conference realignment. Then I want to talk about how Penn State's doing in this crazy world. We'll do that when we come back.
Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by Hall Daddy Hazy IPA, award-winning beer by Greater Good Brewing, built by Penn Staters for PA. Look for the green can at your local retailer.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, quarter number four. He's Steve, I'm Jim. We're looking at college football, a big picture. Real quick, Steve, we've been talking about this House settlement, and there's actually a student athlete by the name of House, and he's the one who took this to court. But by the way, he's not a basketball player. He's not a football player. He actually, I can't even remember if he's a pole vaulter or swimmer. So he's in an Olympic sport, okay? And he was going to college, and he was not able to make outside money where his competitors, other Olympic athletes around the world, were able to get money as Olympic athletes, and he wasn't because he was going to college and he was stuck with the NCAA rules. So that's what really triggered that and is going to lead to this settlement that's coming. So I thought that was kind of fascinating. And Steve, it's interesting to me now going forward. I don't know if you saw this, the ACC was being sued by Florida State and Clemson. They wanted the ability to be free to go to the Southeast Conference or Big Ten. Well, it looks like they've come to a settlement, and what they ended up doing was saying they're going to split revenue where teams who are bringing in more money based on their TV revenues, which means Florida State, Clemson, Miami, those are the big schools, they are going to be making more money than the other folks in the ACC. So they're going to split that in a way if the better teams make more money, which seemed to me to make sense anyway. Might we eventually see, you know, Ohio State, Michigan, Oregon, Penn State saying, you know what, Northwestern, that looks like a pretty good idea to us too, and they'll change the revenue sharing in the big conferences also.
I'm trying to remember, didn't Oklahoma and Texas start off that way, sort of demanding more money in the Big 12 before they exited? So, I mean, I think you're right that there's sort of precedent for that. It's almost sort of sequentially the first step before even further realignment.
Well, the question becomes then, where are we headed with all of this, Steve? And I know people put out there, gee, there'll be just the SEC and Big Ten will break off from the rest of the college football, have their own championship. I personally don't see them getting away with that as far as, oh, we'll drop the Vanderbilts, we'll drop the Northwesterns, and we'll have, you know, 40 teams. Because, and I know I've told you this before, I can't see those teams giving up those gimme wins. Hell, right now they won't give up their out-of-conference games against Podunk so that they could get the sure wins.
I guess I just don't know that you need the sure wins anymore if you get to a system where it's just the SEC and the Big Ten basically working through their own playoff, almost like the AFC-NFC, to get to sort of a Super Bowl scenario where if you just add 500, which is essentially all you need right now to get the NFL playoffs, you know, if you're subsidizing these lesser schools, I don't know how sustainable that's going to be.
Well, if they do that, I can't see them legally getting away with that, you know, depriving, you know, a Clemson who's in the ACC or a Florida State. I could see it happening if you bring along enough of the teams, like the Pac-12 went away because the Big Ten took several of the teams, the ACC took several of the teams. And if you get to that point where, you know, the ACC falls apart or how it works, is it possible, Steve, that you end up with such a big entity anyway, maybe not every team, but enough of the teams who will then split up into geographic divisions and we'll end up pretty close to where we were, you know, 10 years ago, where there is a Pac-12 or maybe they call it the Big Ten West.
Well, I think that's one possible scenario where you sort of continue to expand where the point where it's like it's so big now, you almost just sort of go back to divisions within the conference and more geographical, I guess, based in terms of how you divide them up. I guess the other option potentially is, you know, the schools that are really the revenue drivers here that are, again, subsidizing the lower portion of the conference, do they break off and form their own? Sort of the six or seven schools that, again, are just making significantly or have the potential to make significantly more revenue, again, not subsidize the lesser schools. So they just sort of band together and say, look, it's in our financial interest to do this. And if sort of the top six or so schools from the Big Ten group does that and the SEC do that, then again, do you sort of see this further consolidation there? I don't know.
It's an interesting concept, and I know it's being talked about. Like I said, I find it hard to think that it doesn't end up in court, number one. And number two, thinking it through, you know, will the big school, if all of a sudden, you know, you put together, you like say it's six, seven, eight schools from the Big Ten, well, somebody's going to be at the bottom of that eight. Wisconsin, Iowa, you know, those schools, all of a sudden they're, you know, 0-8 in their conference season. And, you know, do you now have the new Northwestern, you know, the new team that's at the bottom? And do they get, hey, do we get to a point where we get to relegation, you know, like they do in soccer? In the half segment we have left, Steve, I want to translate this into what it means at Penn State and how Penn State has navigated all of this. I think we all felt like Penn State was a bit slow on the NIL side, but it does. Well, I'll ask you, what do you think? How is Penn State navigating transfer portal, NIL, all of this, the arms race?
Much better than they were in terms of recent development. I think they've come a long way. I mean, look, some of these tectonic shifts have actually been in motion for a while. And I think Penn State really put themselves at a disadvantage when having Sandy Barber there as your AD. If you had somebody there that was competent, who actually knew what they were doing, understood football, then you wouldn't be in this position. Now, fortunately, there's Pat Kraft. He seems to actually get it. So he is a much welcome addition. I think that's where you talk about the positive direction Penn State's been moving forward. You know, frankly, we've talked about a lot more about alignment and really elevating the NIL here, tapping into that large alumni base to get here. And Franklin, you know, to his credit, I think has done a pretty good job with the transfer portal. I mean, most of the people he's brought in have been good fits to the team. He's not overly reliant on them. I think he still does a good job of recruiting people that want to be a part of the program and vision that he's, you know, building here at Penn State. So, you know, I think where I would place the blame is Sandy Barber and whoever hired her. That was a complete overreaction to the Sandusky situation, in my opinion. But she really set the program back. And I would add to that, too, giving Franklin that contract deal. I mean, that also was not in Penn State's best interest, whether she was too dumb to realize that or that was her parting gift on the way out. I'm not sure. But I have no love for Sandy Barber, if that's not obvious.
You know, don't hold back, Steve. Don't hold back. Let us know what you really feel. And I do think, you know, James Franklin with the, you know, he uses words like there's the alignment with himself, Pat Kraft, president of the university, the board of directors, board of trustees. And I get that. And I also agree with you that he's done a pretty good job navigating the transfer portal in a way that it's a model that I think works, in that it's more about retaining talent than it is about getting outside talent. And boy, did we see that, you know, this past season. Catron Allen, Nick Singleton, Drew Aller, Deni Dennis Sutton, Zane Durant. That's a boatload of talent that if you combine it, it's not just about retention of talent, but it also means they've been getting the NIL support to bring those guys back.
But even the transfer portal, like a classic example way I think the transfer portal should work is when they got Chop Robinson from Maryland. I may be a little more familiar with him just because I'm down here, but look, this was a guy, coveted recruit, had a good relationship. He goes to Maryland and he's playing out of position. He's playing up in a fort as a linebacker and he wants to be down there as a defensive end. He comes to Penn State, plays a position that he wanted, excels, goes on to the NFL, is making a lot of money. That's how it should work. But again, that was an example of Franklin identifying, here's somebody we know, he's a good fit, the guy's out of position, let's bring him here. I mean, that was to Franklin's credit. A lot of these guys that he's brought in, he had the guy, I forget his name, that came in from Temple too, that played defensive line and was able to tend. And we'll see if he can address some of the needs here at wide receiver. I think that's one area where he's gone to the portal that I haven't really seen him make his many hits in terms of what he's been able to bring in terms of on-field product. But in general, I don't know that you want to be in that situation that Michigan State was in a few years ago with Mel Tucker, when you have all these transfer portal guys coming in. You may get lightning in a bottle for 1 year, but then what's the incentive to stick around? Your whole culture falls apart. And I don't know that they've ever candidly recovered from that.
And, you know, Florida State is the other example that two seasons ago, they had the undefeated regular season. And then, you know, a year later, it all collapses. And both years, they were very dependent on transfers. And, yeah, I think he's been real good about plugging in and finding players that – Nolan Rucci, I think, is another great example, who wasn't playing at Wisconsin. He was a backup there, comes here and, you know, really made a difference. You hit it, though, at wide receiver, they haven't hit. And, you know, it's the one place where this year's team – fingers crossed that he hit. There's two of them that he brought in, and that could determine how far this team goes this year.
I agree, but just overall, I mean, under Kraft, past few years, Penn State's done a really good job of accelerating the NIL. I think Franklin's been pretty effective with the transfer portal. I'm curious with the GM role, you know, what that's going to mean moving forward, both for, you know, Franklin's influence and, you know, Penn State's ability to navigate that. But in my opinion, the thing that was holding Penn State back was Barber.
I tend to agree with you. And I also think it will be interesting to watch. You brought up that GM position, and I don't know if they'll give anyone that title. This is James Franklin's program. If they do hire someone called a GM, it will still be James Franklin's program. And that GM will most likely report to James Franklin.
You might, but that's what I'm wondering, is longer term, is that going to be the last instance of this under Franklin, where program does move on from Franklin at some point? What will that GM reporting structure be? Will they be reporting to Kraft or whomever? Is that the direction this is headed in? You know, how much control is the head coach going to maintain moving forward now when you start bringing in money and general managers and all these things?
As long as you keep paying a coach $10 million, he's probably the guy in charge, Steve. It's always about the money. All right, that is it for our show. Thank you all for listening. Make sure you join us next time on the Keystone Kickoff Show.
Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.